Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the November 2010 episode of Chemistry World with Bibiana Campaseo, Philip Broadwith and Laura Howes. This month, dissolving chewing gum, two Nobel Prizes, implantable LED tattoos, and a way to work out what Fred Flintstone might have been having for dinner.
The whole idea is based upon the fact that different food groups contain different stable isotope ratios. So therefore, if you're consuming a food of one particular isotope ratio, that will be recorded in your skeletal collagen. Things like cereals, for instance, you will be recording the carbon and nitrogen isotope values of the cereals, whereas if you consume, say, marine food, you will record the stable isotope value of the marine food. So by looking at ancient skeletal remains, knowing what we know about the isotope values of the modern materials, we can start to build up pictures of what people are eating in the past.
Richard Evershed, he'll be with us shortly. I'm Chris Smith, and this is Chemistry World.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First up, something to get your teeth into, Bibi.
Yes, in 2007, Terence Cosgrove and his colleagues at the University of Bristol in the UK had been working with a spin-out company called Revolimer, and they actually announced at the time that they had created a new gum which could be removed very easily from most surfaces and also that was water dispersible. Since then, they have been working on the formulation so that they can finally turn this product into a commercial product that is comparable to the available chewing gums in the market that has, you know, they were hoping to get something that had the same taste and consistency.
It's a dream that mothers and people who have to do washing of their kids' clothes have had for years, isn't it? Chewing gum that you can actually get out of something. I presume it's going to work for hair, but tell us about the chemistry. How does it actually work chemically?
Traditional chewing gum uses one of two polymers as a gum-based material. It could be polystyrene co-butadiene or polyethylene co-vinyl acetate. What these guys have done is that they have added an amphiphilic copolymer to this gum base, and they have achieved the desired effect, which is that degradability and then, you know, making it washable. Pretty much.
So what does this amphiphilic polymer or copolymer do? How does it work? How does it change the chemistry of the gum so that you can wash it away?
Well, it has two components. It has a polyisoprene backbone, and then it has grafts of polyethylene oxide. So the polyethylene oxide, or PEO, tends to form complexes with many surfactants, which are very common in normal detergents and soaps, like sodium dodecyl sulfate. And then, obviously, any mild detergent will be able to remove the gum from hair, like you were saying before, or clothes and carpets even. But also, as well, the hydrophilic nature of the PEO means that it's able to retain and absorb water, which then is essential for the degradation of the gum. Basically, it breaks down into small bits of polymer that can be washed away with water.
And you could say a hard act to swallow. Thank you, Bibi. Now, Philip, tell us about another. I reckon the gum should get a Nobel Prize, but it hasn't, but graphene has. So tell us about graphene and why this is important.
Well, Chris, graphene, as anyone who listens to our podcast on a regular basis will know, because we keep going on about it, is single layers of atomically thin carbon. It's like one layer out of a sheet of graphite. And it has a massive array of really interesting properties. It's a molecule, but it's also a crystal, and it's completely two-dimensional. So you have very interesting effects of confining electrons in that two-dimensional structure. So from the physics and from the chemistry, it's a very interesting thing to study.
It is, but what's also interesting is I actually was fortunate to interview André Geim, who's one of the people who got that prize, wasn't it, this month just gone. And what I found fascinating was the way he makes it. And he just said to me quite matter-of-factly, well, I just put a bit of sticky tape on a layer of graphite and rip it off and the graphene is stuck to the sticky tape.
Yes, Chris, that's absolutely right. And that's one of the things that's been recognised with this Nobel Prize is the fact that, Geim's group has a reputation for doing slightly off-the-wall projects, which he calls Friday afternoon things.
He levitated a frog, didn't he?
Indeed, that's right, Chris. He stuck a frog in a very high magnetic field and the diamagnetic interactions of the stuff inside the frog held it levitated in the magnetic field. It's crazy but true.
But this was another Friday afternoon project then?
Yeah, absolutely. So Kostya Novoselov, who's worked in Andre Geim's group for a while, took the idea that graphite is made of layers and thought, well, how do we get one of those off? We'll stick something to the top and peel it off.
Sounds great, but what do we think we can actually do with it? Why is this such a monumental thing? You've said there are some interesting properties, but what sorts of things is graphene going to be used for?
OK, so because it has very interesting electronic properties, you can use it in things like displays. We've seen a few months ago there was a Korean group who made a very large sheet of graphene, a sort of 30-inch diameter sheet of graphene, and they made a working touchscreen display out of it. It's much better in some respects than other materials for that because it's very tough at the same time. It's possibly better than a lot of other materials for the same thing because it's transparent and very tough and very, very thin.
There was a great paper in Nature a few years back, and they were doing imaging of molecules, as in really imaging molecules. It was scanning tunneling electron microscopy. And one of the big problems with actually imaging a molecular species is they keep moving around all over the place. But if you get a sheet of graphene, these researchers found, you can drop molecules onto it. They stick where they're supposed to be, and you can physically see them. And because the graphene is such a regular structure, it's that honeycomb shape, you can easily subtract it digitally from the pictures you get and see physical molecules. I was just gobsmacked to see a molecule of butane having this lovely wiggly pattern, just like we used to draw in the chemistry lab. So I can see why graphene's important in some applications. What about commercially, though?
Well, that's the next step, and that's actually where the chemistry comes in, because it's all very well to get a sheet of sticky tape and peel off a tiny crystal of graphene. If you want to make devices, you've got to make it on a large scale, and to do that, you need chemistry. Most of the large-scale stuff is made by chemical vapour deposition, so you get methane gas or some other source of carbon and heat it very hot and lay it down on a surface, and hopefully you get crystals of graphene. And they're getting better and better at making bigger and bigger crystals, and single layers or just two layers, and controlling how that goes down. So I think very soon we're going to start seeing some commercial technology.
Phil Broadwith on graphene, the stuff that won Andre Geim a Nobel Prize this year. And we'll meet another 2010 Nobel laureate in the form of Eiichi Nagishi, this time in person a bit later on in the programme. But before that, how do you work out what someone who's been dead for thousands of years actually ate? Richard Evershed.
Paleodietary reconstruction is the area that we're interested in exploring, trying to understand what people actually ate in the past.
How easy is that? I mean, when you say in the past, we're not just talking tens of years. In some cases, it's thousands, isn't it?
That's right, thousands of years ago. So we're trying to put together what diet was thousands of years ago, often at times before agriculture, but also then often looking at what people were eating at the time when agriculture was being introduced by, say, Neolithic societies.
In recent weeks, we've seen a group, including Anna Revidin, who published a paper in the journal PNAS from Italy, looking at what people 30,000 years ago were preparing by way of plant matter. And she was analysing starch grains that were embedded into stone tools.
Right.
Such luxuries aren't always available to archaeologists, though, are they?
No, that sort of evidence is quite rare. But we do have other evidence which is much more common, such as the organic molecules that are preserved in skeletal remains, which are very widely distributed at archaeological sites.
So there's actually physically looking at the bones and taking the adage, you are what you eat. So in other words, what goes in ends up turning into you, and there's a chemical signature of that.
That's exactly it. You are what you eat principle is exactly the one that we exploit through these stable isotope techniques.
So tell us about that then. If someone gives you a piece of ancient bone, how do you then go about processing it and understanding where that bone came from, who it belonged to, where they've been and what they did and what they ate?
The first thing you do is demineralise the bone, because the thing we're focusing on are the biochemical constituents, the organic constituents. And so we get rid of the mineral phase, which is most of what you see when you look at a bone. And we then set about recovering the biochemicals, and we've focused on a number of different ones over the years. Lipids are one that we've looked at, but the main one which is studied and which we've been giving a lot of devoting a lot of effort to is collagen, the structural protein that is present in all our bones, which is obviously a biopolymer made up of amino acids.
So how would you look at the collagen? What are you actually looking for when you say stable isotopes? What is that and what can that tell you?
Being a protein, it's obviously made up of amino acids which contain carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen and some sulfur. The carbon and nitrogen are of particular interest as they have the stable isotopes, which are atoms of elements which contain additional neutrons in the nucleus. So they are physically different from the most abundant isotopes. So carbon, for instance, exists in two stable forms, carbon-12, as we call it, and carbon-13 is its stable isotope. And nitrogen has two major stable isotopes, which is nitrogen-14, which is the most common one, and nitrogen-15, which is the one that has the extra neutron.
How do you actually, by comparing the levels of those things, get meaningful information out?
The whole idea is based upon the fact that different food groups or molecules that are coming through different biochemical pathways contain different stable isotope ratios. So therefore, if you're consuming a food of one particular isotope ratio, that will be recorded in your skeletal collagen. If you're consuming another type of food, you will record its isotope value. So for instance, if you're recording things like cereals, for instance, you will be recording the carbon and nitrogen isotope values of the cereals, whereas if you consume, say, marine food, you will record the stable isotope value of the marine food. So by looking at ancient skeletal remains, knowing what we know about the isotope values of the modern materials, we can start to build up pictures of what people were eating in the past.
Can you think of any examples in which this has really helped to clinch things recently?
Well, the direction which our work has gone in is very much one of trying to add a more fundamental basis to this whole stable isotope approach. The technique that was originally developed and that which people have used most commonly currently is to basically extract the whole collagen from the skeletal remains. They then combust it to carbon dioxide and nitrogen in order that you can then determine the nitrogen and carbon isotope values in an isotope ratio mass spectrometer. But what we've been doing is taking apart the collagen at the amino acid level. Collagen is a complex molecule containing a range of amino acids which have different origins potentially in the diets because you have, for instance, essential and non-essential amino acids. And so what we've been doing is pulling apart the collagen at that level in order to hopefully provide us with a better resolution. And one thing that we have discovered through doing this is that if you start to record the carbon isotope values of the different amino acids, you can start to be much more specific about what people were eating. And one example of this is some work we did on some humans from South Africa where the bulk collagen made it very difficult to distinguish what the prehistoric humans were eating there. There was basically an environment where you had C3, C4 and marine foods as potential dietary resources. But by looking at the individual amino acids, we managed to quite unambiguously resolve the individuals that were consuming high amounts of marine protein by a novel amino acid-based proxy. And that is an area which we're now developing, and there's now a lot of interest in around the world now in pulling apart this collagen at the amino acid level because it's now realised that there's much more information if you start to explore it at this fundamental level.
So to make sure I've got this correct, what you're saying is that by dismantling the protein, amino acid by amino acid, separating those amino acids and then analysing them individually, you can pick apart much more carefully and accurately what the different things and different components of that diet must have been.
That's the idea, yes. At the moment, we're still doing the picking apart and testing exactly how far we can go with this resolution. But we have hints that we can go much further than by just using the bulk signal, as we call it. And then, of course, we've also got the nitrogen isotope value, which you can start to look at. And the thing we hope to do in the long run is to perhaps be able to provide a better sort of quantification of the amount of different foods people were actually consuming. Because at the moment, based on the whole collagen, you can't really quantify to any degree the major sort of macronutrients that were in people's diets in the past. So this is the sort of holy grail, is to try and to get to this quantification, and then that's providing with real information on the sort of choices people were making in selecting components of their diet.
Richard Evershed, and he's doing that pioneering work at the University of Bristol. This is Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, new proteins that are stiffer than steel and the LED tattoo. Now that sounds worrying, but not half so scary as a dose of food poisoning that you might pick up from the seafood platter. Thankfully, scientists might have a solution. Laura.
As everyone knows, seafood has a slightly dodgy reputation. If you get a bad, you know, mussel, bad oyster, it can really ruin the next few days.
Well, what can we do about it?
Currently not so much, but hopefully with the work from some guys in California, we might be able to shed some light onto it. There are these small sort of microorganisms that obviously infect our seafood. Seafood is a filter feeder. It takes in water. And so anything that it takes in, it tends to get magnified in amount in its digestive system. That's why they're so bad at picking up gruesome things that make you ill. So Michael Burkatt and colleagues at the University of California have made a fluorescent dye with a tag on the end, which will bind onto one of the chemicals that's made by these gruesome, horrible sort of microorganisms, and will then be able to fluoresce. So if you shine a light on it, you'll get a light response back.
And this gives you an index of suspicion. That one's dodgy, it's glowing green. But some seafood grown near a nuclear power station might do that anyway.
Well, but, possibly.
How does it work, this technique?
How does it work? Well, actually, the technique, in a way, has quite a good acronym itself. It uses fluorescent in situ hybridization, which...
fish
acronym. Okay, it's a good one. But basically, fluorescence obviously works. You shine a light and it shines back by making the dye so that it'll stick onto the actual horrible chemicals that are produced. You get an instant vision of where these toxins are in the body or in your muscle. These tend to obviously focus in the digestive tract. So what Burkatt and colleagues have done is taken the digestive tract out of seafood, wash them in a bit of this dye, and then just shine light on, they get a glowing sign. But also the detection is much better than previously used techniques. So immunological ones where they take the bacteria and they see whether there's an immunological response. You have to go away, get it to grow, and there's a certain problem. This one, it's a lot more responsive and it's immediate. So you can literally take up your muscle that you're growing, pull out one to check, and you've got an immediate sort of glowing response.
I was going to say, because there is a problem with this, which is that people don't just eat one muscle, that someone's come along, taken the digestive tract out and said, yep, that's fine. They eat a bowl of muscles, and someone's not going to be able to painstakingly examine every single one of them. So again, you're still going to have the problem that your technique will work on one. It will act as a kind of an indicator for the group, but there might be another dodgy one in there still, or there may be a whole different pathogen. Norovirus or something might be lurking in there, and this won't pick that up.
Sure, and I think that's a fair problem, but I think... First of all, there's the point that if you are picking up one in a sample and you're picking up as soon as it's being infected, then you can immediately take out that group of muscles and not send them to the restaurant. There's also the point that you could probably change the little binding chemical so that it attaches to norovirus. So although this has been a proof of principle for one particular pathogen, many others could probably be detected by the same way.
Terrific. Thank you. Certainly food for thought. Maybe I'll keep on eschewing the muscles in the meantime, though. Thank you, Laura. Bibi, peptide balls that are stiffer than steel. I'm intrigued.
Yes, they are indeed. A group of scientists based in Israel, in particular at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Rehoboth and also at the Tel Aviv University, they have prepared transparent nanospheres self-assembled from a simple protected dipeptide molecule, and they measured their mechanical properties, and to their surprise they surpassed those of steel and Kevlar.
So what are the chemicals and how do they actually do this? How do they make it happen?
Yes, they produce the spheres using a protected version of diphenylalanine, and in particular the protecting group is N-terbutoxycarbonyl. Initially they had been working trying to produce nanotubes, self-assembled nanotubes with this material. They measured the mechanical properties. They thought they were very good. Then they took the process a little bit, they changed the assembly conditions, and they were able to produce spheres which showed higher strength. They measure a magnitude called Young modulus, which is a measure of the material's stiffness, and it actually was one order of magnitude higher for the spheres than it was for the nanotubes.
What sorts of things could we do with this, though?
Well, the idea at the moment is to use these spheres to strengthen composites. So potential use would be for the reinforcement of materials such as those used for medical implants. But further than that, we don't know yet.
A tough material and some equally tough choices about what we do with it. Thank you, Bibi. Synthesising complicated substances, usually by joining molecules together, is what synthetic chemists frequently do. But sometimes the reactions involved are so long-winded that it's almost unviable to do the work, which is what makes the contribution of three men who won this year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry so important. Two of those scientists were Richard Heck and Akira Suzuki, who each independently discovered how to use palladium as a catalyst to link the previously unlinkable, quickly, simply, and under considerably more mild reacting conditions. The third player in this chemical breakthrough was Eiichi Nagishi.
When I was a PhD student at the University of Pennsylvania, I started running a series of organic reactions, some of which I thought were so roundabout and difficult to run. So I sort of somehow simplifying, you know, I started dreaming. And then one thought I came up with was what I would call a Lego game approach to organic synthesis, in which we just prepare, first of all, R1M, R being any sort of carbon group, attached to the metal, and then R2X. R2 is another carbon group. And in principle, thermodynamically, they should react in the form R1, R2, which we want, plus MX. MX is a very stable salt, so that should go. But in reality, these reactions don't go. And then I started dealing with organoboranes in Professor Brown's group and started thinking about catalyzing organoborane reaction. Organoboranes being R1M. M is a boron in this case. And after a series of failures, well, actually I started using a copper salt as a potential catalyst. But our copper salts were evidently so impure. Hardly anything was working. So we decided to screen a nickel, so-called nickel triad. In the periodic table, you see nickel, palladium, and platinum lined up. At that time, no palladium catalyzed cross-coupling was known, cross-coupling. But when we screened the nickel, palladium, and the platinum emerged as very highly satisfactory element as a catalyst. And then what we did was to screen all sort of conceivable metals that can serve as M part of R1M. We found boron to work, aluminum to work, and then we found the zinc, zirconium, and so on.
And at what point did you realize how much of an impact these reactions were going to have, both at the time and subsequently?
In 1976, 77, 78, those 3 years, we were able to cover sort of a 3x3 matrix in my 10x10 or so chart. I felt that this principle concept must be applicable beyond the 3x3 matrix that we were covering. And I began sensing that this could be a reaction method of a very wide scope.
And how did it then take off from there? When did it dawn on you that you'd actually made the important discovery that was going to change the face of chemistry?
Definitely by 1995, I began feeling that this is how organic chemists should try to make molecules, you know, especially complex molecules.
How does it feel to have been awarded the world's most prestigious science prize for doing that work?
I feel that if this prize recognizes palladium catalyzed cross-coupling as I define, then I think Suzuki's winning and my winning together. Both of us are reasonably proud of what I have done.
What about now, though? Because, forgive me, you're in your 70s, aren't you, and you're still working. What are you going to work on next?
Well, our work and my work on this palladium-catalyzed cross-coupling, I consider it to be a little more than 50 halfway through. And I have been continuously exploring along this line, which I definitely would like to do as long as I can. I have not done anything in concrete way. That is to use transition metal catalysis for artificial photosynthesis, converting the mixture of carbon dioxide, which is hated by by the world. And so chemically converting CO2 and water into useful things. I hope to be able to contribute in my own way to the advancement of this part of chemistry.
And if he can come up with an artificial form of photosynthesis to lock up CO2, then who knows, perhaps he'll win another Nobel Prize. That was one of this year's Nobel laureates, Eiichi Nagishi from Purdue University. Now, as if some people's skin decorations aren't bad enough already, scientists have come up with LEDs that you can implant, which is making me very wary, Laura.
You could be wary. You could have them tattooed under your skin. Who knows what you'll be doing with them? This is an interesting paper that's come out of Illinois in the States, and a guy called John Rogers, who does quite a lot of fun stuff with making fun circuits and doing things. And he's basically combined sort of various work that he's done to make these amazing flexible LEDs that are very small, and they're held within a polymer, a flexible polymer called polydimethyl siloxane, or PDMS, which is also, not only does it waterproof these new flexible LED arrays, but it's biocompatible. So potentially you could put them in your skin.
So they bend around, you can move them about.
Yeah.
How does he get that to happen? Why doesn't the contacts and the connections just get broken every time you move them?
Yeah, so that's a good question. But actually what he does is actually quite interesting. It's a bit like if you were to draw on a balloon and then shrink it down, your drawing gets sort of squished down into a smaller size. What he does is he stretches out his PDMS and puts it on top of his LED array and then just lets go, and it all kind of shrinks up.
And that means the wires go with
this
it.
This means
so
the wires
sort of
just all
up.
Sort of coil up in this nice little pattern, which means that they can be pulled apart and stretched. And he's got loads and loads of amazing pictures where he's pulling them over pencils and folding them around bits of paper and scrunching them up. And they're just quite happily glowing away.
What would you use them for, though?
This is one of the really interesting things about this paper. John Rogers has actually done quite a lot of potential applications, talked about quite a lot of things. He's looking at potentially putting these patches under your skin, like LED tattoos, like I was saying. So perhaps you could have a glowing display. Perhaps you could put them in to track what's happening in your body, or for sort of photodynamic therapy. So if you've got cancer and you need your drug to be photoactivated, then you can put it under around your cancer and direct the drug therapy to your cancer. So that's one idea, which is why the PDMS is so useful, the fact it's biocompatible. But he's also done fun things, like he's put them on the end of surgical gloves, doctor's gloves. He's looking at, maybe you can, when you're going in for surgery, you've got, you can light up to see what you're doing.
I thought you were going to say you can shed light where the sun don't shine.
Oh, well, you know, you could do that too.
Thought
but
did
I'm
occur.
Not, I'm not sure whether I'd want that to be quite what they're doing.
No, but practically that does sound really rather useful, because there are some areas where surgeons do have to put their hands where it is difficult to see.
Yeah.
And having an additional light source that wasn't going to get in their way does sound actually very useful.
Yeah, so rather than worrying about the fact that your head's in the way of the light that you're trying to shine over, you can your hand's just there and you can see where your hands are.
Indeed. Laura, thank you for shedding some light on that. Now, moving swiftly on, or should I say maybe a weighty story now, Philip. Tell us about these crystals.
OK, Chris. Well, these are tiny crystals that can lift over 600 times their own weight just by shining a light on them.
Sounds like an ant. What do they do? What are they?
Well, they're made by some guys from Japan called Masahiro Irie and Masakatsu Morimoto, and they're both at Rikyu University. And a couple of years ago, Irie made crystals from a molecule called from derivatives of diaryl ethylene, which, when you shine UV light on it, changes its shape, with the idea that the whole crystal would change its shape. But the problem was that those were very brittle, So what they've done now is incorporated another molecule to act as a kind of lubricant or plasticizer within the crystal, and that's a perfluoronaphthalene. So now you can make the they've made these co-crystals where the two molecules crystallize together, you shine the light on them, and they bend and they can lift up these weights.
How does it work, though? How do they get the light to do that?
Okay, well, the light causes the diaryl ethene to change shape, and that shape transfer, because of the way the crystals are packed, is transferred into a macroscopic shape change of the crystal.
Is it reversible? If you take the light away, does it go back to how it started then?
Yeah, absolutely. So because this shape change is a higher energy state of the molecule, if you take the light, the energy source away, they slowly relax back. So it's a completely reversible switching process.
Sounds fantastic. What can you do with it, though?
Well, there's a lot of things in electronics at the moment that are done by what are called piezoelectric materials, which when you apply an electric current, they change shape, or when you change the shape, you get an electric current. But if you wanted to do the same kind of things completely wirelessly, you could have one of these little crystals in there and shine a light on it rather than applying a current.
Can you give us some examples physically of where that might be useful, though?
So if you wanted to have a valve that would open in, say, a microfluidic device, and you wanted to have it light-triggered. So, for example, if you were doing a photochemical reaction, when you turn the light on, which starts the chemistry, you also open the valve so the stuff flows through, that kind of thing.
Well, now you've made light of that very weighty item, Phil, time for this month's chemical trivia slot. So tell us about hydrogen.
OK, Chris. Well, something that's always astounded me is the sheer amount of empty space there is within molecules. So if you think of hydrogen, which is one of the simplest molecules that we know, two atoms of hydrogen joined by a single bond, if you scale up the nucleus or the proton at the centre of one of those hydrogen atoms to the size of 1 metre in diameter, how far away do you think the other hydrogen atom would be?
I haven't got a clue, actually, but I know that a proton is about 10 to the minus 15 metres, so that's a femtometre. So if you made that 1 metre, you'd therefore be making it 10 to the 15 times bigger. So how big's the bond then? I'm stuck. You're going to have to help me.
OK, well, Chris, it turns out to be just over 42 kilometres.
What, to the other hydrogen atom?
Absolutely. Well, the hydrogen-hydrogen bond length, measured from nucleus to nucleus, is about 74 picometres. About 74 picometres. A picometre is 10 to the minus 12 metres. So it's 10,000 times bigger.
Roughly. That's really interesting, isn't it, to get your head around this, because you've basically, with hydrogen being so simple, you have a nucleon and an electron whizzing round. You've got two of them forming a molecule, H2, so they're sharing those two electrons and they're whizzing round the outside of both atoms. So that means that actually it's a very long way between the two, and also that the electron is from its own proton at times. I'm quite surprised, actually, that it's such a big distance.
Absolutely. Those electrons have got quite a lot of work to do.
Yeah, OK, well, there you go, an astounding fact. Presumably, if anyone else has an astounding chemical calculational fact, they can send it in to you.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love to hear all your favourite chemistry trivia, and if you send some in to us, we might even send you a fabulous Chemistry World goodie bag.
And the address to which you should send your chemical calculation requests, go on, give Phil some hard work to do, is chemistryworld@rsc.org. That's it for this month. Thank you to our contributors, Phil Broadwith, Laura Howes and Bibiana Campaseo. The production was by Miracentha Lingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. Until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.